I'm Stephanie Wilson, and you're listening to Freedom Over Fascism.
Two of the big words we've been talking about throughout this conversation, one is, you know, representation in that inclusive way, right? That everybody has a place in these communities and in these curricula as equals, as full parts of these communities. And then that idea of citizenship, right? And citizenship as active and engaged and critical and forward-looking.
Hi, friends. Happy Thanksgiving. During the course of this show, we've talked about the importance of teaching and learning honest history. All over the country, MAGA politicians and social groups have been working to change the social studies curriculum, primarily around the history of enslavement and race relations in the United States. What's at stake is the question of who can be considered a real American. As I discussed with Professor Ben Railton, white Christian nationalists try to change the way we teach history and literature to reinforce the hierarchies where white Christian men hold the dominant positions. They try to remove agency from anyone from a marginalized group who might want to challenge the dominance of straight white Christian men. They try to deprive BIPOC, non-Christian, and LGBTQ plus kids of the ability to see themselves in literature and in honest history as part of their efforts to squelch kids' imagination and curiosity, as well as their ability to see different perspectives than their own in history and literature. The way we talk and learn about Thanksgiving is part of this conversation. The myth of the Pilgrims, English religious zealots who landed in what is now Massachusetts in 1620 and got along famously with the native people they found, is one of the foundational myths of the United States. By now, most of us know that the story is inaccurate and exists to justify European colonization of North America. It also serves as part of the narrative defining who has the right to call themselves a real American. In this narrative, where the Puritans disembarked into the waiting arms of the indigenous folks, white Christian settlers emerge as more capable than they actually were and less violent than they became. We don't learn about how precarious their survival was, which helps cement the narrative that placed white Christians at the top of the hierarchy and emphasized the role of Native Americans as helpful guides who were ultimately expendable, as the white Christians learned to survive without them. Most school history books teach that the Native people handed off America to white people so they could create a great nation dedicated to liberty, opportunity, and Christianity for the rest of the world to profit. What's missing from this narrative is that the Puritans' first interaction with the Wampanoag was when the Puritans stole the Wampanoag's winter provisions. What's also missing is the genocide that ultimately killed or relocated 95% of the indigenous people across North America. Once again, our founding mythology removes agency from the indigenous population and sets their opposition to further settlement as an opposition to the divinely ordained white Christian settlement of North America. All of this subtext is built into the holiday that we barely think about as we hurry to gather with family or friends for a traditional ritual in which we stuff ourselves silly and possibly watch football at the same time. This year, as MAGA Republicans attempt to define who is American, with their attempts to take away our freedoms one by one, we can see how they're trying to rewrite our future as they redefine our past. I talked to Professor Ben Railton about social studies curriculum and its importance in defining who we are and where we're going. As we take a pause for a couple minutes, I hope we can think about how we're going to fight for freedom for all Americans over the coming year. Before we start our conversation, I ask for your help supporting this podcast. You can become a paid subscriber at HoosierVictoryAlliance.substack.com or a patron at patreon.com/freedomoverfascism. Please leave a review or rating on Apple Podcasts. Now for my conversation with Professor Ben Railton. Welcome back, Ben. We've got a new name, but our goals are the same. Are you ready to talk about history and identity today?
I sure am. And thanks so much for having me back, Stephanie. I had a great conversation the last time, and I really like My sons like to say my favorite quote, the thing I say the most is, let's keep the conversation going. And I think it's true. I say it about once a day at least. And so this is a great chance to keep a conversation going. I'm really glad to be able to do that.
I am too. And I think that that's a really important thing. One of the things that I think is most important is curiosity and, you know, figuring out how things fit together. So I'm hoping that we can spark some curiosity today and satisfy a little of our own. So first, I wanted to talk about curriculum that we've seen in the news. We've recently seen that Florida changed its social studies standards, and Florida and Oklahoma and some other states are adopting curriculum from the right-wing Prager University. And I saw an Atlantic article this week by Adam Serwer. He places this change and attack on history instruction as a response to the 1619 Project. Can you tell us a little bit about that project and then what you think the right wing is attempting to do?
Absolutely. And I also want to give a shout out to another great recent article that was thinking about some of those things. Tara Hunter, the historian, had a great piece in the new magazine Hammer and Hope, which is a kind of radical African-American history magazine that was thinking about some of those same things with Florida and 1619. So folks should check that out, too. And all of Hammer and Hope, which is great. And what I think actually Hammer and Hope and the 1619 Project have in common is how different they are from the kind of the mythic, to use a term I know we'll keep talking about, the mythic narratives of them that the right is propagating and that really leads to some of these, I think, these curricular efforts. So there's this kind of stereotype of the 1619 Project, I would argue, that is the idea that it is explicitly anti-American, that it is sort of offering a really overtly negative portrayal of America, the worst of America, as kind of like who America is, and teaching students that kind of negativity, that kind of anti-American narrative of all the worst that the country has been and included and done and featured. And I would argue not only that that's not true, but that the opposite is true, that what a curriculum like that is offering, and the 1619 Project was a media project for the, you know, New York Times Magazine, but it features curricular elements and then has been modified as something that can be included in schools, not the only curriculum, but included in schools. And I think what it offers as a curriculum is two layers, one of which is absolutely the idea of exploring all of the nuances and the complexities and the spectrum of what American history has featured, specifically in that case around African-American history and slavery and segregation and racism, but also just broadly the idea of the full nuanced picture of American history. And then there is a second layer that may not be as much in the curriculum, but is in the project for sure, which is what I call and have thought a lot about in recent years, critical patriotism, saying, how do we then push toward the ideals of America when we are engaging with the worst, rather than just ignoring or forgetting or minimizing? How do we then think about how we can fight for the ideals in this place that has featured the worst as well? So I think that second layer, again, is really what is entirely absent. The first layer is entirely misrepresented by the critics, I would say. But the second layer is entirely absent from the way the critics and the negative voices have thought about something like the 1619 Project. And so what that then means in terms of these right-wing curricula is, as we'll talk about, I know, A, they're offering a much less nuanced and really simplified and whitewashed vision of history. But B, there's this idea that that's the way to get to patriotism, is to only think about the most idealized version of us, of America and American history, and only offer students that, so that presumably they will then sort of instantly and entirely, I would say, worship, but at least love and idealize this place. And again, I think those are two very different visions, not only of history, but also then of that idea of what it means to be an American citizen and of teaching that and learning that. And so I think that is a lot of the stakes of this, is the debate between not just those two models, but the false mythologized vision of something like the 1619 Project, and then the alternative that these right-wing curricula are offering in response to those falsehoods, and then in the problematic ways that I believe they are.
And embedded in that is the idea that the 1619 Project had a specific agenda, mm-hmm. which, as you're saying, it's the idea that patriotism requires us to understand the past honestly in order to make a better present. But the idea that the sanitized, whitewashed versions do not have an ideological aspects, which is also entirely false, because every historical project embeds the ideas and ideals and values of the people who are propagating it. And that's just the way narratives work. We surface the narratives that we think are the most important to our time and place. And I think that one of the things that Florida and Oklahoma and these whitewashed ideas of history is doing is trying to teach the idea that slavery really wasn't that bad. And so that racial hierarchy, really not so bad. So when that racial hierarchy is in the present as they want it to be, then that's natural and normal. And there's no reason really to fight against it, because that's the natural normal state of America.
Yeah, I agree. And I think there's a couple layers to what makes that so problematic. Obviously, there are very blatant layers of just racism and prejudice and, again, false visions of our fellow Americans. And those things are deeply problematic. And we see them on multiple levels. The Florida curriculum, for example, the Florida African-American Studies curriculum, the revised, includes a lot of info about enslaved white people in Europe, which has no purpose other than that racist kind of like blending and blurring of, see, there's been slavery in different places, different times. It's just it's a natural thing. In fact, America's version may have been better than some of these others, all those kinds of false narratives. So there's a lot of that that I would call blatant racism, as you're nicely putting it. But then that second layer as well, the idea that in order to only idealize America, it requires us to come up with these really mythic ways of understanding. Again, the worst of us, right? Because these narratives are not so blatantly propagandistic that they can't acknowledge slavery at all. They have to acknowledge it as a thing that existed. But then if we're thinking about an idealized myth of the past, it has to then become something, as you say, that was positive, that was ultimately natural and understandable and just of the times and even had benefits, and then can be fit into that narrative so cleanly. And besides, again, being inaccurate and false and really racist toward, among other things, enslaved people and African-Americans more broadly. The other problem with that is it allows for no agency from students who are learning it in terms of what it might mean for fighting for justice in the present, as you're saying, right? Quite the opposite. It suggests that this is just the sort of the natural way of things. Teaching students to become engaged citizens is not job one of education, right? Job one is to educate, to provide knowledge and information and skills and ways of being a student and a learner. But job two, I think we all probably agree, the question is obviously what the end game is, but we all agree that job two in American public education and education is to help people become better citizens, right? Engaged citizens of the nation and the world. And I would argue, again, even on that level, these curriculum are failing because they don't allow for that possibility. It's simply a matter of kind of learning and regurgitating myths. So that's the real sort of like danger of indoctrination, right? Is teaching things that don't allow any sense of engaged citizenship or active participation, just this passive kind of regurgitation of the myths. If there's any indoctrination happening, it would be that, rather than helping students become engaged and active and critical in the way that they are part of a society. So I think that's another really problematic layer on top of the racism and the falsehoods, is where the indoctrination is really seeking to happen or happen.
The interesting thing about this is it's so blatant that it's caused conversation. Mm-hmm. You know, we're having a conversation about this, and the country in some aspects is having a conversation about this, but it's been going on for a long time, more under the radar, this whole teaching of myths and regurgitating it. One example being the big ones that I'm thinking about. One is the idea that the Civil War was about states' rights and not about slavery, completely erasing the idea that slavery really was at the center. And the second is the Alamo, let's say. We all have this idea of, right, fighting for the Alamo, Davy Crockett, David Bowie, you know, heroism. I don't know whether it was ever taught, but these were Americans coming into Mexico trying to import slavery, right? Mm-hmm. And you know the story, but not a lot of people do, because we've been indoctrinated for so long between what we learn in school and the popular movies. And it all had a level of indoctrination that we weren't necessarily aware of unless we were historians. Whereas right now, it's really something that we're surfacing and bringing to the fore. And I think that that is kind of another layer that we can talk about, is what was the mythology even before this change in the African-American studies curriculum and the general history curriculum in Florida in particular.
Yeah, it reminds me of a great moment. The recently passed away really wonderful popular historian and educator James Lowen, best known for the book Lies My Teacher Told Me. He talks in the preface of one of his projects about his first job as an educator, which was at a college in Mississippi, I think Tougaloo College, where he spent a lot of time. But anyway, he was at a college in Mississippi in the early 70s, and he had almost entirely African-American students. It was a historically Black college. And those African-American students, to a person, as he tells the story, believed, had been taught, that Reconstruction after the Civil War was entirely about sort of African-American failures. And all of the blame for all of the failings that happened in that era were due to African-American overreach and problems and, you know, all those narratives, all those narratives that were the way Reconstruction was taught nationwide for about 100 years or almost 100 years, from the early 1900s up to at least the late 1900s, the turn of the 21st century. And so you could see in that moment not only that kind of indoctrination and the way that histories were being taught, despite abundant evidence to know better, like Du Bois's Black Reconstruction in America, which is from 1935, and laid out really clearly why that narrative was so false, but still being taught for decades and decades after that. And not only that it was being taught, but what that meant then for these American students, what that meant for their understanding of not only history and America, but of themselves, right? And of their identities. And obviously that's particularly poignant and horrible for students of color, but we can extrapolate that to all students, right? And to the way they were learning. And yeah, for me growing up in Virginia in the 1980s in public schools and the way I learned about the Civil War, the way I learned about Reconstruction, all of these histories that you're noting, was absolutely at least a form of mythologizing and an indoctrination, or at least an embrace of those myths. And then again, that means things not only about the history, but about where we are, about where the students are, where the young people are, and how we move forward. And so it's only very briefly, as you're very nicely highlighting, it's only very briefly that our educational systems had started to move away from that, I would argue, and challenge that. And so this is really, to some degree, an even more overt backlash to this very recent attempt to get better at the way we do that. But as you say, the benefit of that is now it is a lot more all foregrounded rather than that century or centuries of more understated but very, very present mythologizing. So we are in a moment where who knows where it's going to go, but at least we are able to more overtly not only have the present conversation, but recognize that long history and then think about what we might do instead and how we can move forward with the more nuanced versions instead on all these layers, right? Whether it's, you know, LGBTQ Americans or Mexican Americans, Hispanic Americans, African Americans, Asian American studies, all of it. We had started to make small inroads. This is a huge moment of backlash, but it allows us to think about each of those stages and where we want to go. So I do think there's a lot of possibility in that, as well as peril, of course.
Yeah, I think that you kind of juxtaposing the possibility and the peril is really important. And I have to say, I grew up in California in the 1980s, and those are the stories I got. I mean, there wasn't a whole lot of, at least in the public schools, variation, I think, in curriculum. And frankly, my U.S. history teacher in high school was this man in his 80s from maybe Nebraska who talked about the great unwashed mass. And, you know, so it was fully this indoctrination, mythological history. But frankly, when we're talking about history and identity and memory, you know, part of teaching these common myths, whether they're honest or not, is an attempt to create a shared origin story. And our origin story is so intensely layered and complicated that it has, as all societies do, you know, have big implications for how we see ourselves in the present and see our past and see our relationship to other types of people. And do we see ourselves in the stories of the past? And in those stories that we learned, really only white, straight Christian kids got a chance to see themselves in the stories. And the Black and brown kids saw very little. And what they saw was not people with agency. So I think that that is a really important layering, as you were talking about.
And I think one of the most frustrating things about the current right-wing narratives is the idea that white students, for example, if they learn these more nuanced, the worst and everything else, for are going to be ashamed or going to feel negative about themselves, rather than, for example, besides, again, the genuine benefits of learning the hardest stuff, find all kinds of inspiration in all kinds of figures and moments too. So just as an example of that, I have written and talked a lot in multiple projects about these enslaved people in Massachusetts who, during and after the American Revolution, fought for their own freedom along with allies using the language of things like the Declaration of Independence and the Massachusetts Constitution of 1780 to argue for why slavery should be illegal, because it was still entirely legal in Mass throughout the Revolution. And they succeeded not only in gaining their own freedom, but in helping end slavery in Massachusetts. This is Elizabeth Freeman, Quack Walker, and their allies. And those allies included amazing white Massachusetts residents like Theodore Sedgwick, the lawyer who represented Elizabeth Freeman as she brought her case all the way to the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court and won a victory there. So, A, the idea that there aren't figures that white students could be inspired by in the hardest histories is false. But B, yes, representation is important, but of course, white students have never had a shortage of it. But the idea that white students, that any student couldn't be inspired by Freeman, for example, is just not, to me, accurate to the way that we work as humans and how we learn and what we can connect to. And so I find that really, really not only frustrating, but really patronizing, you know, the idea that young white students are going to only be ashamed of the worst of what some white people have done and what America has included, rather than find inspiration as well as knowledge from the best. And you only get the best, I always argue, through those kind of moments that also feature the hardest and the worst. So there's a lot of layers to it. And yes, representation needs to continue to be a part of it. And we can get to that through the hardest histories too. But we also get so much that we can offer our students that I know from teaching for 25 years now is incredibly meaningful to all students. So there's so many layers to the kind of myth that these right-wing curricula and narratives are based on. And that's, I think, a layer of it as well, that students are going to feel negatively rather than all the real benefits that can come from learning more fully.
In my interview last week with Representative Gloria Johnson from Tennessee, who was a public school teacher for 27 years before she became a state representative and is now running for Senate, said that, you know, as MAGA is defunding public schools in the places where they hold the power, she noted that public education is the bedrock of democracy. And that's a truism that's been stated for 100 years. But is that true? And what is it about publication? I think that there's more layers that we can look into. Is what are we teaching in public education that makes it democratic or not? That I think it's interesting to look at.
I agree. And you know, some of the things that are part of that I would argue accurate truism. Some of the parts of it are not limited to public education, right? Like, you know, critical thinking and knowledge. And, you know, those are things that can be taught in many different settings and should be taught in every setting for sure. So there's those layers that are important. But I do agree that there are layers of the public system in particular. And so one just perhaps obvious, but impossible for me to overstate example of it is that cross-section of our community, right? That true attempt to bring together all Americans, not because they've chosen to be in a particular place or are paying to be in a particular place or have one kind of option or another, which all of which is true to one degree or another of more private education or alternative educational systems that depend on choice and money and the way people can navigate them. public education, with all of its continued challenges and struggles, is the opposite. It's a place that just brings together the members of a community, of all of our communities, and puts them in the same rooms, the same spaces, the same conversations to do those other things. Think critically, read, learn, talk, engage, develop these skills, develop their voices, listen to each other, all the things. And so I've talked in so many of my projects about inclusion as an American ideal versus exclusion as the other end of that spectrum. And there's no space in America that can be more inclusive than public schools. Again, there's all sorts of shortcomings and ways in which they too often are not. Here in Massachusetts, our schools, our public schools are very segregated economically and racially and otherwise because of the way we fund them and all sorts of other issues that we need to address. So it's not that they always achieve that, but that is a central part of the goal. And a part of what public education can be is genuinely that inclusive model. And then if people are learning to become things like engaged, active, critical citizens, which again can happen in any educational space, but if they're learning that in a community, in a space that is inclusive, that is as diverse as we are, at least that's the goal and the thing to fight for, that pulls together both those threads, right? The individual's role and what our community is and should be. And those two things in combination, each of us individually and then the American community at its best, is I think everything. And again, I think public education can at its best offer that in a way that very few other spaces can. So I think it's hard to overstate how important that is. And, you know, I was a product of the public schools. I've taught in a public university for 20 years now. And again, it is a space that at its best can be that. And so, yes, I think it is a bedrock of democracy. I think it is a bedrock of our community at its best that we need to be fighting for, not only in these curricular battles, but absolutely in terms of funding and support and collective recognition and arguments for its importance, and then for the work of teachers and librarians and all the other layers that play into that. We can't take it for granted. We have to be making that case on every level, again, well beyond just these curricular conversations, which, as we were saying, are hugely important, but just the space itself, the community itself. So that's a central tenet of everything I do, for sure.
Right. And I think that that's one of the biggest reasons that MAGA and the right wing is trying to defund public education in the name of choice, which is really choice for people to leave the public education system. And because that they know that at its best, it can be educating people toward the idea of bringing people together and giving them, you know, fancy ideas about inclusion and equality that they don't believe in. This is very dramatically intertwined. And I too am a product of the public schools, and we can have a very large conversation about whether public schools, they're actually serving the community they need to be serving. But I think that, as you say, the idea of educating people simply because they are people and members of the community is incredibly important in places where not only is the public education system being systematically defunded and downgraded, there are places, particularly Indiana, let's say, where civics education isn't taught. In my public high school in California, you know, there was an American government, everyone had to take an American government class. And that, you know, at whatever level was really about what civic participation is about. And by removing any classes on civic participation, the right wing is aiding their project of suppressing the vote and making people not understand the power of citizenship that they can wield.
Yeah, I agree. And it's the, again, sort of two of the big words we've been talking about all day today, then throughout this conversation. One is, you know, representation in that inclusive way, right? That everybody has a place in these communities and in these curricula as equals, as full parts of these communities. So representation in that way, or inclusion, and then that idea of citizenship, right? And citizenship as active and engaged and critical and forward-looking. Both of those are being described in these attacks as, in one way or another, indoctrination, right? Teaching that gay people exist, for example, right? Saying the word, that is presented as a form of indoctrination by these narratives. And then teaching the idea of things like challenge and resistance and debate and protest and so on, also presented in these right-wing narratives, these attacks as a form of indoctrination. I would argue the exact opposite is the case, right? That the reality is that we're all here, we're all part of these communities, and the reality is we all have a role to play if the community is going to be at its best. So ignoring or eliding or explicitly downgrading those things, that's the indoctrination, and presenting them as a huge part of the story is then giving people the tools to sort of figure out their voice and their role in it. And that's the opposite of indoctrination, right? Is giving everyone the tools to be part of that. To figure out what they want to be, what they want to say, how they want to be part of every level of their community is the furthest thing from indoctrination. It's about empowering all individuals to be a part of it. So I do think that word has become so important and so exactly opposite to the way that we need to think about it, where and how indoctrination is occurring and what it would mean to challenge that with that sense of individual and collective empowerment and citizenship and communal presence. So I just think that's a huge part of pushing back on these narratives as well.
And one of the ways that students can be equipped to push back on them is learning the different elements of United States history that have been suppressed for so long. Things that the everyday citizen probably doesn't know anything about because they haven't been taught for so long. Things like the different kinds of immigration that was allowed or disallowed, say the Chinese exclusion, and I have a 10th grader and I was just telling him about the Chinese exclusion and Japanese internment, and that in the 60s, this urban renewal that drove highways into the middle of African-American communities. And he was shocked. He was absolutely shocked and appalled that this could happen in this ideal world that he would like to live in, and B, that isn't talked about granted, he's only in 10th grade, so he hasn't had a lot of opportunities to learn about it, but the concept that these things would happen was shocking and appalling to him. And that's kind of the reaction you would want to engage their curiosity to find out more so that they could really be equipped to handle whatever's coming next.
And as I had said, but as you were just noting as well, I think to reiterate it, within those also you have communal responses, individual responses that are the best of us, that are inspiring, that are activists, that are protests, that are alternatives, that again, every student and every American can also be inspired by, and that we're not going to get if we're not also learning those hardest things, right? And that those responses of shock and disappointment and frustration, just as one other layer of this, they're going to happen at some point, because eventually, even with the best efforts of the propagandistic voices, unless we become fully, you know, George Orwell's 1984, eventually people do start to encounter and learn about these other things. The key is not, even if we wanted to, and I don't, the key is not to avoid all of that. It's to present it in ways that allow people to engage it and learn about it, and then, again, keep figuring it out. So even just leaving aside any of the questions of, again, politics and curricula and whatever else, it's impossible to not eventually be part of the world in all its complexity. That's part of what we want to be teaching, rather than, again, minimizing and trying to avoid for as long as possible, which seems to be the kind of the goal of these suppressing narratives. So foregrounding the complexities and saying, and then here's all the different ways you can learn and grow and be inspired and recognize the realities. All of that is, again, a big part of what education should do. And that's for everybody. That has nothing to do with one political argument or one partisan question. That's about how we are part of the world. So I just think it's a disservice on every level, including just what it means to be a human being figuring those things out, to try to present history or anything that elides and minimizes all of those kinds of realities and nuances.
Exactly. And this whole idea that presenting the past as complex centers the white kids in such a way that, say, Black kids or gay kids or Jewish kids or Muslim kids, they don't get to ignore a lot of these things because they're present in their lives all the time. So the idea that we're this big white fantasy land that's magically delicious is really a false idea of protecting white kids that no other race, ethnicity, religion gets to have. And we know that life experiences are really important to how you view the world, right? But also we know that kids can handle an awful lot. And I think the people who want to protect children don't really know children, right? I mean, first of all, that they shouldn't encounter any degree of problematica. These kids, their lives are problematic. Like everything is big. All their emotions are big. And if you think that kids aren't thinking about these things, you haven't been talking to kids. But also we know that, say, I'm Jewish, and in the Jewish community, we teach our children about Jewish history and the Holocaust, which has a lot of hard times. We teach it relatively early, and we teach it with compassion. And we know that there are ways to help kids deal with difficult subjects. Resources and thought and creativity and nuance are brought to it. So the idea that it's impossible to teach kids hard things is very easily proven untrue.
It is. And I think at the end of the day, and this is a parallel topic, but it goes to what you were just saying, at the end of the day, protecting children in that narrative, in this particular way, is really more about, again, protecting sort of a status quo view of the world that exactly. The adults in question have. And yes, as kids learn these things, it becomes impossible to simply accept that status quo world as the only possibility. That does become impossible. But again, that's both American and human to figure out that that's not enough, that there's more complexity and more possibility for us. Because again, in the status quo version, there's very little for us to do, especially young people, other than, I guess, just learn it and regurgitate it in that genuine version of indoctrination, rather than recognize its presence, but also its limitations and all the other things around and outside and beyond it, and then imagine their role in that. So, yes, it is impossible to only accept the status quo when you learn in all these ways. And I think that is scary to a certain portion of adults. And again, leaving politics aside, understandably, we all have certain kind of stories about the world that we're invested in. But the idea that we wouldn't want kids, our kids, all kids, to have the tools to take next steps, to go beyond that, is sad to me, right? I mean, if there's any shared idea of an American dream, it's that, right? That like the next generation has an even better chance, has it even better. And part of that is not simply any status quo, but is what they can move forward into. So that's not protecting. That's, again, ultimately limiting them because of our own maybe fears or our own stories. And we obviously don't want that to be what education is doing.
I think we see in Gen Z and these kids that are coming up right now an awareness in very large numbers that the world is far more complicated and far more not complex and nuanced than they've been taught. And as we see them come into their own, we see a lot of them speaking out and engaging with difficult subjects in the public sphere that we haven't seen in a long time.
I agree. I think I probably said this when we last talked because I say it every chance I get, but I'm a congenital optimist struggling like crazy in 2023 to keep finding reasons for that optimism. But when I do, a lot of it has to do with the younger generations, young people, whether it's my students, whether it's my sons and their peers in high school, all of it, both and more, for all those reasons, including, yes, that genuine sense of engagement and activism and curiosity and passion, along with all the kid stuff that they're all doing too, and that's really important as well. And that we should protect our ability to be kids as well within this world, but also how much these generations are far beyond where I believe mine was when it comes to all of those questions. And that is inspiring. And the last thing we want to do then, any of us should want to do, leaving all these other questions aside, is to try to beat down any of that, right? Rather than encourage it. And again, it's not the first goal of a class or education, but it's a goal, right? Is to encourage them to lean more into sort of all the best of what they are starting to build. All of that is an example of it. And again, it's the source of the most hope, I think, for the future of the country and the world, is what those young people are already and what they can continue to build into. And that too is a big part of what we should be encouraging and making part of our education, rather than seeking to suppress.
Well, I think that you have said it very eloquently and wrapped it up really nicely there. So thanks for coming back and being our resident American historian. I hope you come back and we'll discuss more of these ideas as we go along with this podcast. And I've really enjoyed having this conversation with you today.
I agree. Thank you so much, Stephanie, and doing really important work. I'll just say one last thing. Education, if it ever was, and it probably wasn't, is clearly no longer simply in, you know, brick and mortar institutions, right? It happens in all of these spaces, including the digital and the public scholarly. Those two are part of education. So being able to be part of that in these spaces means a lot.
Well, thank you. And we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening. Please join our Patreon at patreon.com/freedomoverfascism and subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. We thank you for choosing Freedom Over Fascism.